Good evening. You are listening to the ENR podcast. Today is Wednesday, the 6th of March, 2024. Joining me this evening, we have special guest again, Louise from the committee. Good evening, Louise.
Hi.
And Roman.
Yura.
And of course, Mark.
Of course, I'm not going anywhere. And, here forever.
And myself, Craig, in case you don't know who I am. How's everybody's week been so far?
Good, I think, in one word. Do you want more than one word?
I don't know. Well, I went and saw my back specialist today, so the health update is that that there may be some action on my back. It actually has improved since the last time we recorded. So that is thankful, and seems to have regressed a bit to the mean, which is nice.
I guess all skeptics in New Zealand are waiting on tenterhooks to figure out which homeopathic or alternative or complementary therapy you are going to be subjecting your body to. Are you going to follow the Mark Honeychurch formula?
I'm not getting a coffee enema for a start.
Well, he hasn't gotten the coffee enema yet, so that remains to be seen.
No,
What hypothesis are you going to be testing out with alternative medicine on your back?
Nothing at all. No. Although I am going back to the physio tomorrow, so we'll see whether she actually performs anything miraculous. But no, it'll be completely science-based, evidence-based.
Disappointing. Very disappointing. As a skeptic, your mind's supposed to be open. You're supposed to be willing to try anything.
Yeah, right. Well, maybe I'll have some complementary approach in conjunction with the medical technology that they bring to bear.
Do it. And then you can claim it was all that complementary therapy.
Exactly.
Totally forget to mention the doctors that worked on you as well. It's not like we haven't seen this before.
Well, maybe I can just get our listeners to pray for me.
Yeah. So there's a faith healer down in Christchurch who I think he had stomach cancer and went through multiple surgeries, and the doctors did some amazing work. Now that he's a faith healer, whenever he gives his public demonstrations of faith healing, all he talks about is how God healed him. And it's like, well, excuse me, what about all the medical professionals and the hundreds of thousands of taxpayers' dollars that went into curing you? You're not even mentioning that.
No, of course not. Of course not. But speaking of people praying for me, I got a little letter in the mail today. It was actually a printed envelope and said to the householder of my address, and it came from a PO box in Westgate, which is sort of 10 minutes down the road from where I live. But when I opened it up, it was a handwritten letter from Elizabeth from the Jehovah's Witnesses, and she said that she hoped that my letter. That her letter finds me well, and
no. Back problems.
Oh,
strike
well,
one.
You think I? Well, she's actually given me her cell phone number, so maybe I should give her a call and let her know about my problems that didn't find me well.
We should compare these cell phone numbers and see if they all are the same cell phone number that goes to a call center that's manned by non-Jehovah's Witness who are just sort of giving us thoughts and prayers.
Yeah. Well, mine's an 021 number with a lot more digits than you normally see in an 021 number, actually.
So it's 021, between 6 and
091.
8, so presumably yeah, well, it's 8?
Yes, 8 digits. Yes, after the 021. Yeah.
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 Well,
but
I was looking at a copy of my letter, which came from Birchville in Upper Hutt, and they don't want me to call them. They didn't give me a cell phone number.
Oh, okay.
So Craig, you're just letting down the team by not, you know, doing these experiments and calling the people. Mark would be all over that. Like,
yeah, I can't see where my letters are. I've got a few of them somewhere, but they're not handily available, unfortunately.
Well, I was intrigued by some of the content of this letter. She says that people around the Earth are enduring a record-breaking heat wave and other extreme weather events. The Weather Meteorological Org states that as the planet warms, we can expect more intense change in weather conditions. Does this report concern you? And will we get to the stage where the Earth will become unlivable? And she goes on to say that God created mankind and provided man with a beautiful paradise garden to live in. His purpose was for us to enjoy life and our surroundings. His purpose hasn't changed. How and when will he return the earth to its original condition?
And do you know why he has to return the earth to its original condition?
Enlighten me.
Because the Jehovah's Witnesses think that only 144,000 are going to heaven, and it turns out that Jehovah's Witnesses have had their entire allotment used already. So the promise for everybody who's a JW now is that they inherit the new earth and not heaven. So this is why earth has to be restored, and this is why a lot of their lectures and sermons these days just talk about how amazing the new earth is going to be, about how the lion is going to live with the lamb and everything's going to be peaceful and crops will grow easily. It'll be the easiest life ever. But yeah, it's basically because the new earth is a consolation prize for the modern JWs, which is a little bit sad, really, that they're not getting to go to heaven.
Well, the occupants of heaven might have earth envy.
I suppose if it's that good,
Earth
that might
be a better place.
I mean, and that's pretty, that, you know, that's really like a contemporary, trying to be salient, trying to be relevant kind of letter. This is what Janet wrote me. My name is Janet, and I live in Avalon. Now, you know, this person's probably sent a bajillion emails or letters to across our region, so I'm not, I don't mind
reading
these details.
Didn't Roxy Music write a song about that place?
Was it Roxy Music?
Yes.
No idea. I'm not that old.
Well,
support
I'm definitely
me,
not
Louise.
That old.
Surely you remember Avalon from Roxy Music.
Absolutely, Brian Ferry.
Yeah, exactly. Anyway, okay. Sorry, carry on.
Yes, I'm today. I am writing to invite you to a special public talk on the 3rd of March, 24 at 10 a.m. Sunday in brackets. As if, you know, I guess the heathens don't know what a Sunday is. The topic of this talk will be the resurrection, victory over death. This amazing Bible truth is one of God's promises, very soon to be realized, and will bring such joy to each and every one of us. Please come along and enjoy this thrilling talk. There is no charge for their event, and there's plenty of free parking at the above address. We hope you'll
be
able
to join us. Is there plenty of free parking because nobody's turning up? Is it like, you know, five congregants, and so the car park is empty? That's nice.
Well, yeah, JWs tend to have pretty big car parks.
Yeah.
Presumably there. They're going on about resurrection because it's coming up to Easter.
Yeah, so their Easter service, I can definitely recommend. If you do any JW service just to gawk, do the Easter service, because the one fascinating thing, again, related to the 144,000, is that they have a communion, but you can only partake of the communion if you're one of the 144,000. And so what they have is a communion that gets passed from the front to the back, but nobody's allowed to touch it. So it just goes totally untouched. It's like ceremonial, but you can't, because the 144,000 have all died already, so nobody has any right to take the communion. It's weird.
Do you know whether they serve hot cross buns?
I didn't see any the time that I was there, and I didn't smell any hot cross buns, but maybe they were for members only and they just kept them secret from me. But probably not.
I wonder what the Jehovah's Witnesses' opinions on hot cross buns are. Anyway.
They're down on a lot of things. They really are such depressing downers. I can imagine that they don't think, I mean, they don't think much of birthdays or Christmas. They don't like celebrating either of those. So the chance of them celebrating Jesus's death seems quite slim.
Okay, so I just Googled it and I've seen a headline saying Jehovah's Witness forced school to ban hot cross buns.
There we go.
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, total fuddy-duddies.
Terrible. Yeah. Anyway, and Louise, I understand that you've received ongoing correspondence from Scientology.
Yeah, it's 25 years since we bought our property, and I've been sending these hand addressed envelopes back to return to sender, not known at this address. You know, even going into such detail as to say we've lived here 25 years and I've never heard of this person, and still they keep coming. So I thought, oh damn it, I'm just going to open one. And, yeah, the contents were rather thrilling. It says, dear person whose name I've redacted, a long time ago, 49 years ago, in fact, you came into our organisation and bought a copy of the famous book Dianetics. Please let me know you're still alive and kicking. How's that for tenacity? 49 years. 49 years of spam.
they've been sending letters for 49 years trying to get a follow-up from this person that bought the book. Wow.
Seriously, I'm so glad I opened it. I just about corpsed laughing.
I mean, surely that's eaten through all the profits they made from selling the book, plus some, the amount they've paid on postage.
Yeah, and the record keeping, because, you know, presumably 49 years ago, they had a handwritten ledger like Charles Dickens or something, you know, and with a quill pen to see that this guy had come and bought their Dianetics book.
Well, for interesting enough, when I've done archive work at the National Library, I've sometimes come across like the correspondence that they would send to individuals, and they would do it by hand. They'd have the really nice letterhead with, you know, sometimes even referencing their headquarters. And yeah, they hand by hand. But the thing is, they probably don't carry it anymore because they burnt all those records just before they had the inquest back in the 60s. Ah. They burnt all their files and it made the news because they were offering, you know, here, look, if the journalists want to have evidence of who's actually part of our organization or what our files are, come have a look before we set it on fire so we don't have to give it to the government for examination. So there's a whole history, a whole history of, you know, from the 40s to the 60s gone up in smoke.
Yeah, I guess everything since then has been stored. And yeah, Louise, if you ever pop into their Ideal Org in Auckland, if you go into the building and turn left, you'll see there's their bookshop where they sell you the books and audio tapes or probably CDs these days. And if you look behind that at the back, I think that is where their records office still is. It certainly was when Craig and I were there on the inauguration day. But there's like a sealed room. There's a little glass piece in the door. And if you look behind there, you can just see all these filing cabinets where they store everything. You know, this is the standard stuff we know about as skeptics, where Scientologists run audits where you tell them your deepest, darkest secrets, and then they basically write it down and use it to blackmail you so you never leave. That kind of stuff is there.
Yeah, well, 49 years later, I feel sorry for this guy if he still exists. Well, she wants to know if he's alive and kicking. I can't tell her. No idea.
I mean, that's just so weird. Like, you know, diminishing returns. You figure after a year or two, you give in. But 49 years of trying to get hold of someone, that's weird. Like, that's so tenacious that there's something odd going on there.
Like, at what point would they stop? Like, would they wait till they got the 100 years, or are they just going to be expecting that, you know, the Thetans will maybe answer your letters instead?
Maybe they have actuarian tables and they'll figure out his projected lifetime and just stop at that point.
Yes. Maybe they made a note of how old he was when he bought the book and can figure out how long he's likely to live for.
That's all on the Dickensian ledger. Yeah, I can just imagine.
Well, I think that one takes the cake.
Yeah, that is pretty impressive. You need to frame that and put it up in your house somewhere, because that's great.
Well, I just wish that I'd waited another year to open one, because then it would have been the Golden Jubilee. It would have said that 50 years ago you came and bought the Dianetics book.
Well, we will get you on the podcast this time next year, and we'll see if another one has turned up with 50 years on it.
In a gold-edged envelope.
You diarize that, Mark.
Yeah, I will ask Google later to put it in my calendar.
Louise, you're going to tell us about some of the goings-on with our magnificent king.
Yes, indeed. So I have to start with a confession, which is that I have worked both for a London tabloid and for 20 years for the New Zealand Women's Weekly. So you have to forgive me.
You know quite a lot about the royals then.
Quite an intimate knowledge of the royal family. Very fond of. I think they're lovely. I think they're a nice, you know, an institution that kind of joins people together. You know, call me Pollyanna, but there's something quite nice about it. I was just thinking the other night when I was prowling around Buckingham Palace in London and actually noting just before I go anywhere else that the king seems to be doing some outsourcing or some trying to find some extra revenue, because the courtyard to Buckingham Palace is absolutely full of royal mail vans. So I don't know whether whether they're paying to put their vans there at night or what's going on, but there were dozens of them.
That's weird.
Yeah, and they can't all be delivering good wishes and so on to the king, I'm sure.
Maybe the idea is to make it look like the king's getting good wishes, so he's just ordered that a dozen vans are permanently parked there.
Oh, it could be too. Yeah, of course, I'm not that skeptical. I didn't even think like that. I thought he was
How
running
long
out of
ago was
money.
this? How long
No,
ago was
about
this?
2 weeks ago.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. No, I was doing my royal crawl of London, past Clarence House. And yeah, but of course, the interesting thing is that he's not living in Buckingham Palace. He prefers not to. So he lives in his own house nearby. But
Nice if you
anyway,
can afford it.
very nice if you've got that choice of properties. But
Right.
anyway, the well, the heir, as we used to call him, but of course now the monarch, is grappling with some serious health issues. And yes, it turns out that he went to hospital for a procedure on the Royal Crown Jewels in January, and something
Very
else was
good.
identified. And turns out that he has some form of the Big C, which, well, what we previously called the Big C before COVID. And he hasn't said what it is. There's a bit of conjecture. Apparently, it's quite common to discover bladder cancer, for example, when you're having prostate surgery or procedures. But the interesting thing is that he is with the London Clinic. He will be having the very best care possible, the most cutting-edge therapies, chemotherapy, radiotherapy, whatever he's having, and whether he's still dabbling in his preferred health treatments, such as homeopathy and other complementary, as he likes to call them, therapies. So, yeah, it's quite an interesting time for conjecture about that. But you can be damn sure that whatever happens, like the faith healer with the stomach cancer mark, whatever happens, he's bound to praise the alternative therapies rather than anything conventional or scientific.
Yeah, you mentioned one interesting therapy, Gerson, that he was he's been promoting that in the past, not for his own cancer, but for other people, and has had his wrist slapped in the past, right?
Yeah, I mean, the general oncology body came down really hard on him for this sort of carry on, and that was actually quite a few years ago. But yeah, Gerson therapy is a ghastly thing. It was invented in Germany by a guy called Gerson, actually, surprisingly, about the 1930s. Yeah, it involves a lot of juicing of various fruits, obviously, and vegetables. These coffee enemas. I mean, what on earth are you supposed to achieve by giving yourself a coffee enema? I have got no idea. But there are some absolute horror stories of people who've died absolutely ghastly, malingering deaths having subscribed to the Gerson therapy and eschewed normal, conventional treatments for cancer. So obviously, it's not a good thing. And somehow, I actually doubt that he is doing coffee enemas.
Yeah.
Hey, I was going to say it doesn't sound very royal, but now I'm remembering back to the letters that he sent to Camilla, the sexual ones, and that wasn't very royal either, but it didn't stop him.
No, there was a sort of a
It
focus
was a
on
different
the
orifice,
nether
though, back.
regions there too, wasn't there? In fact, I remember when Tampon Gate occurred, and I was working for the Telegraph in London, and it was before the internet. But you could actually dial a number. I think it was at the Sun, and you could hear they played the recorded recordings. It was
Oh,
like the old days
geez.
of dial a prayer. You know, you could dial the prayer or dial a weather forecast, and you could dial up and listen to Prince Charles's
Wow.
recordings to Camilla. So, of course, we all took great delight in doing that in the office, in the newsroom.
Oh, the media really did have a field day with that one. But yeah, I'd hate to think he is using complementary therapy for something so serious, even for King Charles. You know, it's not nice to think of anybody relying on these therapies. But as you say, if he is, he's going to be getting the best proper medical treatment as well. And the worry is that he'll then tout this alternative therapy as being the thing that cured him. And like Gerson, or I don't know whether he's ever promoted Essiac, which is another dodgy cancer treatment. That one's just like a tea with a few ingredients in it. But again, people that sell it in this country and other countries, they'll tell you it will cure all cancers. You know, they're so confident with their proclamations, and yet obviously it does nothing. It's just total nonsense.
When I was doing the Jessie Lee Ward, who I kind of wrote about her cancer journey, what, a few months ago now, in terms of her MLM. Oh God, she's dead, and you know, but she was at like up until probably maybe a couple of days before she died, she was talking about doing coffee enemas. She would be on doing lives while the coffee enema was going on, while she was
Wow.
lying on the floor of the bathroom. She wasn't doing Gerson, but she was talking about doing Gerson. She was also talking about going to, you know, some absolutely bullshit cancer clinics in Mexico, which I think maybe one of the Gerson therapies is big clinics is in Mexico. But she was doing lots of juicing and trying to promote these juicers and eat drinking nothing but juice. while all the time denying these like this advanced stomach cancer that she had.
I guess for me with King Charles, one of the most annoying things is like if he personally wants to use his alternative therapies, go ahead. You know, it might kill you. That's your choice. You're an adult. But the fact is that he doesn't keep it to himself, right? You know, for one, he promotes it publicly. But for two, he also had that really, I guess, fairly public spat back in the day with Edzard Ernst. And that was really annoying to see that he went and basically stuck his oar in where it definitely wasn't warranted.
Oh, he stuck that oar in many times over the years, actually. I read Edzard Ernst's book, Charles the Alternative Prince, as he was then, when I was researching the story. And Charles has been amazingly vocal and he's had amazing, support. Insofar as he even wrote to Tony Blair at one stage and advocated for more use of complementary therapies in the NHS, I believe that it was effective.
I guess one thing we can just say about King Charles is that he really must be a true believer. He's certainly not in it to sell alternative therapies, is it?
He's not in it for the money because he's already got enough.
Exactly.
Well, actually, one of the points that I made is that through his Duchy of Cornwall, he's got a village there, Poundbury, where they do all sorts of organic farming and so on. Mm. They actually produce some tinctures, which was from dandelion and something else.
Duchy Botanicals?
Yeah, something like that. They do gin too, actually. I saw that in Fortnum and Mason's the other day. It looked quite nice, but couldn't bring any back. But yeah, he was roundly pilloried for that too, because the claims they were making about these tinctures were, clearly outlandish and dangerous. And it was actually quite a slight for him because it was very public. But it didn't seem to, he didn't seem to back down. I mean, he clearly believes it. I think it's because he's fundamentally quite insecure and felt very much that he had to prove himself early on as a prince.
Sure. Yeah.
Yeah. So he kind of picked a few causes, didn't he? Because environmentalism was another cause that he picked. At least with that one, he picked something that was somewhat evidence-based, even if not all his projects and the stuff he was interested in maybe were great. At least the general concept of trying to look after the environment is a positive one. But with alternative medicine, he really has just picked a dead horse. I mean, there is nothing useful to alternative medicine. And as Tim Minchin has said, anything that is just becomes medicine, right?
Yeah. Do you think that as a public figure, he should actually be really revealing what particular cancer he has? Because by not revealing it, it's just leading to a whole bunch of speculation as to what it could be.
I think people are a little bit more interested in why Kate has been out of the public eye. Because she just says, she's had abdominal surgery. And everyone's like, why is she taking so long? This is not a normal abdominal surgery. And she said nothing. Whereas I think Charles has kind of abated some. You know, he's an old man and he says he's had cancer. You know, there's, people can speculate on cancer, but people know he has cancer. No one knows what's up with Kate Middleton. And that's
I certainly didn't know that she had surgery. That's how little attention I paid to the royals.
Oh, that's been sort of like the dual story. Charles has cancer and like within days of each other, they kind of actually had that dual, press release because they're like, yeah, Kate's having a planned abdominal surgery and she'll be offline until after Easter.
Okay.
Well, if you want the women's magazine take on that too, I don't think it was planned for very long. She looked remarkably well a few days earlier. And to spend 2 weeks in hospital is unusual in this day and age. And then 3 weeks of at least 3 months of recuperation out of the public eye is also quite unusual. So, and having had very major abdominal surgery myself and gone through a similar time frame, it has to be very, very major.
Well, I guess if we follow David Icke's theory, maybe she's a reptilian and there's something along the lines of alien and giving birth to a baby out of the stomach.
That's sure to be it.
Indeed. Not that we're ones to promote conspiracy theories.
Or David Icke, who's, an anti-Semite? But I have paid him money. I will admit, I have given him money to go and see him live. I am guilty in this regard.
Right. Now on to more depressing stuff. Apparently, embryos are people.
Yeah, some people would be very happy. They would not see that as sad news, but I think in terms of this ongoing deterioration of women's rights in the post-Roe versus Wade world, yeah, it's a bit sad. So for people who may not be familiar with what's going on, around the end of February, Alabama, the state of Alabama in the US, in the United States, went viral in the worst way by announcing that, yeah, embryos are people. Or have personhood in a sense. What initiated this whole thing is because people want to sue. Back in December 2020, a patient at this hospital was able to wander into a fertility clinic. Now, normally these fertility clinics, you know, where they store the embryos, it's a sub-zero storage facility. Basically, embryos are kept frozen. And somehow a patient wandered into this very special cryogenic clinic. And was able to access a container containing about maybe a good six or seven embryos, I believe. But because, of course, it's sub-zero liquid nitrogen, their hand got burnt. By burning their hand, they dropped the container and end up destroying a few embryos. A legal case ensued, and initially in what's in the trial court in Alabama, much of the lawsuits that were initially put forth were dismissed because, you know, there's no way that the embryos fell under wrongful death, under the wrongful death of a minor, but there was a potential for looking at breach of contract. So one of the lawsuits was still kind of up in the air as to whether the family had grounds to sue on that. So an appeal was launched to the Supreme Court, and because the Alabama Supreme Court has lots of Christians on it, and particularly a lot of Dominionist, very extreme conservative Christians in that court. When you read the appeal judgment, it's basically unlike any other judgment you would read. It's basically the book of Genesis, Thomas Aquinas. And, you know, there's other court cases and law jargon that's, it feels like it's only put in there for a little bit of flavor.
So basically, this whole thing is just like this court case is a convenient excuse. What the religious right want is an end to abortion, and to be able to claim that from conception, a fetus is a person is a good way of banning all abortion. And the fact that this is, you know, it's not a direct abortion case, I suppose, makes it a little bit easier to do in some ways, that they can use this case about the destruction of embryos as a basically just an excuse to push through their agenda.
From
what I
it
understand, the it was already established in Alabama law that life begins at conception. And so an embryo was always considered to be a person. But the different thing about this case is these are extra uterine embryos versus ones that have been implanted.
Yeah, so there's this weird thing. It has to do with a couple of things, really, in terms of Alabama law. There's a couple of statutes and pieces of legislation in there that you don't see in any other state. Basically, one piece is, you know, when it comes to wrongful death damages in Alabama, basically the court determined way back in a railroad case in 1877 that the job of the court is to punish the wrongdoers. It's not to sort of put out compensation. So when they put out, you know, when they do fines or when they issue penalties, it's to punish people. It's not to compensate families. So to be more precise, it's about rather than awarding actual damages for one's loss, Alabama's really only awarding punitive damages for punishment, and it's to serve as a deterrent. So how do you deter a hospital? You know, what how does that work? And in the event of the wrongful death of a minor under the age of 19, parents, that's probably the only, like, one of the few cases where someone can ask for damages in the event of the death of a minor. Parents have about 6 months to file that lawsuit. What the court of Alabama made clear is that the court, yes, as you said, the court, all everyone in the court agrees that the life of unborn child begins at fertilization and qualifies as, you know, that qualifies as life regardless of viability. The issue, again, as you said, was about determining how to make that work when the embryo was extrauterine. Because while that embryo is implanted, there's always a possibility that, yes, it could have been viable, it could have grown into a baby. Whereas if extrauterine, of course, like if there's no womb, it's not anywhere, it's not going to live. It will die. It'll be disposed because it won't be able to survive. outside of the womb. And so one of the things I sort of looked at in terms of maybe potentially a precedent that could have been set in terms of looking at this from a legal standpoint, in terms of the idea of like, you know, what are the rights of a fetus outside the womb before it was actually born, would be looking at the cases of fetal abduction, which is when babies have been removed. You know, I guess you could say it's like a C-section, but, you know, there's quite a few cases of fetal abduction where people stole babies from pregnant women kind of before viability.
Wow. Oh, America, we love you so much.
But I mean, these aren't, but you know, again, this is not like an embryo. These are babies of like 6, 7, 8, 9 months who probably with good care could have survived. You know, if that happens at a hospital and you have automatic NICU services, then yeah, these babies usually would have had a good chance of surviving in any normal circumstances. An embryo has no chance of surviving in any circumstance. But as it so happens, there actually weren't sort of a case that any lawyer could make a precedent for necessarily in Alabama. Usually the mother and baby die, so the legal entity that's sort of there's any punishment being meted out for is for the murder of the mother. There's not actually sometimes the murder is not being done because of the baby, because you have to determine one of the things you have to determine is whether the baby was alive before it was born. Let me repeat that. You have to make sure the baby, after that baby was removed from the fetus, from the womb, you need to make sure that the baby was alive. And then if it died afterwards, you can potentially say it's murder. But if it was removed from the womb and it had, you know, either died really quickly or had already been dead, can you really say it's murder?
That would be a very hard case to make, though, wouldn't it? The coincidence that at this time when they did this forced fetal abduction, that the baby was already dead. Mm-hmm. Surely not. I want to know what was going through the patient's mind that they thought they could wander into this place and they'd open up this freezer and go and pick out these embryos.
I don't know anything about the hospital itself, but I mean, I think the biggest concern is how could that lab have been left unlocked and unsecured for anybody to walk in. But I mean, I'm certain if you could think of any sort of reason, it could be, it could be dementia, could be, diminished mental capacity. Could it have been someone trying to make a point? That would be sort of obviously be slid off with an Occam razor right there. But maybe more details will come through once these parents decide to go through a lawsuit. While I was sort of doing my research, it's really interesting that the implications of this could actually come through quite quickly, particularly in Alabama, because earlier, like sort of at the end of 2023, quite a few families who had embryos in process, in storage, potentially over 100 in the US alone, were no good, because a company that sort of creates the solution that embryos are put in for, like the culturing, the culture media that's used to develop and grow embryos, was found to be contaminated. It was missing an essential nutrient. So all these embryos just weren't developing. They were, you know, quote unquote, they weren't any good anymore. While some of these families received a payout from the company, now with what's happened in Alabama, anyone who may have lost a embryo in Alabama has this new realm in which they can go back after this company, a new lawsuit that they can create.
So as I understand it, it's common practice that with IVF, you have many more embryos than are likely to be used. And so you use the ones that hopefully become a pregnancy and then others are disposed of. But now is that murder by disposing of those embryos?
And that's the thing. In Alabama, there's multiple responses. There were some fertility clinics that were just like, look, you know, yes, this is clearly an oversight by the court. We're going to continue practicing as normal. And we trust that the, you know, Alabama legislature will right any wrongs. And then you had others who are like, we're stopping right away. This is way too ambiguous. We do not want to be sued. We do not want to get in trouble. We're putting a halt to all fertility treatments. And of course, a lot of people got upset. But what sort of made me chuckle was that there was a clinic that said, we were just about to dispose of embryos that had been abandoned. You know, some of them were as old as 16 years. These were teenage embryos.
So this is, this is an American problem, isn't it, about disposing of embryos? And apparently in a lot of states where there are laws that are either restrictive or ambiguous, embryos that are held originally for IVF are just kept forever because people are worried about, you know, getting in trouble for doing anything with them. So they just end up sitting in perpetuity frozen, which is, again, it's America. It's weird.
Maybe 49 years, they'll get a letter.
Well, but this is the thing, you know, you have this law that's done this one thing, which is, okay, we're going to give embryos personhood. We're going to say, yep, this is life. And we, you know, parents can sue for the loss of a minor that hasn't even been born yet. There's implications of that. As soon as you say, okay, an embryo is a living thing, what does that mean in terms of what can people can claim as a dependent? We're looking at, okay, do we look at child abandonment? You know, what does it mean if you abandon an embryo for 10, 15, 16 years? You know,
so what I'm interested in, the bit that I want to see is what the Satanic Temple does with it, whether they're going to get pregnant women to drive around in the T2 lane and, you know, try and deliberately get tickets for only having one person and then proving that there's actually two of them in the car, that kind of thing. Like, I know the Satanic Temple is very good and very creative at coming out with ways of showing just how daft religious-based laws are. And I really hope this is a case they're interested in.
Yeah, but, you know, this is Alabama, and the ultimate hypocrisy of this whole situation is that this is a state with like one of the worst death penalties. Like, you know, usually with a death penalty, you need a unanimous agreement by the jury. Not in Alabama. If the jury's not in agreement and the judge decides that someone, you know, if it's a death penalty case, so to speak, if the jury doesn't have consensus, the judge can decide if someone can goes to the chair. So, you know, tell me about the sanctity of life in that case.
Terrible situation. But yeah, presumably they're going to have to do something about it because they obviously don't want to end the IVF programs. Mm-hmm. Let people go out of state to have an IVF program.
Well, I mean, you've got to be careful about going out of state for an abortion. Well, they won't charge the person who has the abortion. They will persecute and prosecute anyone who helps a woman leave Alabama to have an abortion. But what they're doing in terms of this IVF F-up is on March 1st, both the House and the Senate put together sort of pretty equivalent bills that provided immunity for death and damage of an embryo to the individual who was or entity who was providing goods and service in relation to IVF, so that no action, suit, or criminal prosecution was able to be brought. And I think it's going to be Wednesday in the U.S., so that'll be tomorrow for us, whether that bill gets passed in the higher house.
Yeah, so they're essentially just creating a loophole to get them out of the situation that their stupid policy has got them into.
Yeah, but the way this policy has ended up working is that, those parents who put forth the original suit are kind of potentially could be back in the same place as they were at the beginning. You know, here they go. They want to sue the hospital that, you know, lost their embryos. And now this new law has come out saying, nope, you can't sue them because they wanted to protect, you know, IVF services. So something that was probably potentially intended to, we want to say potentially it was meant in all good faith to help this family, but really what ended up is that the families are back at ground zero and the only winners are actually the pro-life movement.
In all good faith, that sounds like a pun if ever I've heard one.
In all bad faith.
Well, I guess we'll have to watch the space and see what happens.
Stop it, Craig. But yes, watch the space.
Well, I mean, where will we watch the space? I mean, the one of our news organizations is potentially going out of business. So there would be fewer places to watch the space, unfortunately. So it was announced last week, I think it was, that News Hub is going to stop doing the news. They're basically axing up to 300 jobs. People based on in TV3, as it's known as Warner Brothers Discovery, which incidentally was the place I went to last year when I was on the 7 Days show. That's run by Warner Brothers Discovery. But yeah, so unfortunately, it looks like News Hub is going away. And so there'll no longer be a 3 News at 6 p.m. So we're really only left with TVNZ News. And I believe that Prime is still in existence doing news. Correct me
and
if I'm
reality
wrong.
Check radio and
well,
the
yes.
platform.
Yeah, so there are still
and
news
us,
outlets.
We are a key news outlet for New Zealand skeptics.
Right, okay. Yeah, well, we're not on 6 p.m. every day. Yes, I mean, it's a shame that a lot of professional journalism is going away. And, of course, the reason for that, the cited, is that the advertising revenue that the TV companies are making has dwindled. I guess I don't know how many of us would sit down and watch free-to-air TV and watch the news. But even if you don't, quite often the stories that are put on the news and written by professional journalists are then picked up by other media. It's put on social media. So there's still that benefit of having those professional journalists producing that news that gets to be seen by others at some later date. And I think the problem is that when these news organizations, these professional news organizations are going away, then these unprofessional organizations are going to come in and fill a gap. So the likes of Chantelle Baker and her investigative reporting. Is she the equivalent of a professional journalist?
I don't think she's even the equivalent of a tenth of a professional journalist.
Oh, and there's Counterspin Media. And so these people, like Chantelle Baker and Kelvin Elp from Counterspin Media, they were essentially dancing on the grave of News Hub. They were celebrating the fact that these people are going to lose their jobs and that the mainstream media is being weakened because they see that it is all driven by some narrative that the mainstream media are trying to push, or it's controlled by the government, which was the sort of claims that we saw when during the COVID pandemic, the government introduced the Public Interest Journalism Fund. That was the $55 million of funding that they put together to allow journalism to continue during the pandemic. So there's always been this accusation that by journalists and news organizations taking funding from the government, that they were somehow tainted in their news reporting, that they would have to support the government. I don't think that really, really stands up. That particular fund was run by New Zealand On Air, completely independent from the government, and it was essentially funding for sort of specific projects that people had to sort of apply for the funding for a particular project. And it was essentially what it sounds like, public interest journalism. So it's producing stories that the public will be interested in. So that fund has now closed, but there's existing approvals of projects that are going to run through until 2026. I guess the problem that we're seeing is that once you lose professional journalists in these news organizations, then people will just continue to get their news from social media, which is obviously unreliable. And obviously driven by clicks and eyeballs. And I was interested to hear a press conference given by our Prime Minister, Christopher Luxon, and the Minister of Education, Erica Sanford. And a reporter asked her about her appearance on Reality Check Radio. And it turns out that she was on Reality Check Radio, interviewed by Peter Williams. And so the reporter was sort of saying, do you think it's appropriate for a government minister to be on Reality Check Radio when they have many people that they're interviewed on there that are from sort of extreme political organizations? So the example that was given is a guy called Martin Sellner, who is part of the identitarian movement in Austria. So he was interviewed on Reality Check Radio, and he was in communication with the mosque shooter and accepted donations from him. So it's kind of shocking. I guess it's drawing a pretty long bow there to say that Erica Sanford, who's the Minister of Education, shouldn't be on Reality Check Radio because Reality Check Radio has interviewed some pretty awful people. But I guess the principle is there that the government really should be careful about where it does interviews, which sort of taints the I don't know, the impression that people get of the government by association. I had a look through the Reality Check Radio page to see who Peter Williams had interviewed, and there's some pretty odious people that he's got on there. But yeah, it's I guess as a society we need to think about how we go about funding news and funding journalists. And of course the recent approach has been perhaps to ask internet companies, social media companies, and Google and so on to help pay for journalism, because they are part of the problem of essentially gutting our media outlets. And so in Australia, Meta, who own Facebook, had been funding the news organisations over there, but recently it was just announced that they're going to stop doing that. And they reckon that it's because their Facebook news has become not as popular. And they said the number of people using Facebook news in Australia and the US has dropped by over 80% in the last year. We know that people don't come to Facebook for news and political content. They come to connect with people and discover new opportunities, passions, and interests.
From what I'm seeing of Facebook recently, all I'm getting is adverts. So yeah. I'm not there for the adverts, but what I'm seeing is adverts. I think Facebook has a lot of control over what people see. So if they say people aren't going there for the news, that's more likely because they're not putting the news in front of people's faces than because people are voting with their feet and choosing not to read the news on there. Like it's Facebook's choice. They write the algorithm, they tweak these things, they choose what mix of things we see.
Yeah. Yeah, I guess it's whatever gets the most engagement and allows them to show more ads, and perhaps the news wasn't doing that for them.
Yeah, or maybe it's just that they're, you know, a little bit bitter about the fact they've had to pay the media in Australia, and all it takes is changing a single variable and they can basically show fewer news stories.
Yeah. Anyway, so... yeah, it's going to be very sad to see the demise of a news organisation. Interestingly, now that this news has come out about News Hub itself in its stories and criticism of the government has been much more brutal. So there was that thing recently about Christopher Luxon claiming the $52,000 a year accommodation supplement, and they did quite a long story on it that it was particularly brutal of him.
Yeah, so, that didn't go down well, did it? That was a quick reversal.
Yes. So maybe for the next few months, we're going to see some quite impressive work coming out of News Hub. They don't care about what people will think about it, or what the government thinks about it, at least. Anyway, that'll be interesting to see. We'll have to watch this space. So, Mark, have you been pwned lately?
Well, now I'm going to have to explain what that means, just in case people think that I'm in a porn movie or something.
Heaven forbid.
What do you mean? Have you not seen what Ron Jeremy looks like?
It's been many years since I've seen what Ron Jeremy looked like.
All right. Anyway, yes. So Queen pones a lot. Yeah, so this was... I like my internet dramas, and this was a drama that just it pushed a lot of buttons for me. It made me very happy. Queen Pwns a Lot is basically a game streamer, and game streaming mostly happens on Twitch these days. So twitch.tv is a website where you can stream yourself playing computer games, and for some unfathomable reason people will throw money at you for doing it. And you can subscribe when you're watching Twitch for a month or multiple months to this person. You can gift subscriptions to other people who are also watching the stream. You can throw bits at them. And I think one bit is one US cent, but you can give 100 bits or 300 bits to the streamer. And there are other different ways that you can basically give money. Streamers can also make money from advertising, so they can either play adverts, let's say, when they go for a loo break while they're playing the game, because some of these sessions are like 9, 10, 12 hours long. You know, these people play games for an entire day. But they also have their product placements. So it's a whole bunch of energy drinks, and it's like not even good stuff. The stuff they're selling, it's all the same, and it's all... God knows. If teenagers are drinking it, they're probably all going to die or become sterile. So it might be that this is the end of the world. Looking at some of these drinks, the names and the ingredients in them, it's pretty scary. But anyway, so that's a quick background on game streaming and my obvious disdain for it. But it turns out, as I said, people can make a living from it, and people do make a living from it. And sometimes it's doing some weird things. And Queen pones a lot. Let me explain the name quickly. So pwn is a misspelling of own, because P and O are next to each other on a QWERTY keyboard. And to own in a game means to beat thoroughly. So if you thrash someone, you own them in a game. And so Queen pwns a lot is saying that she can play games really well because she can beat people a lot. That's what the name means. But so she is a streamer on Twitch, not a huge streamer by any means, but she's got a small loyal following, and she plays a game called Monster Hunter. Monster Hunter World is her preferred version of this game. I actually just started playing Monster Hunter Rise, the newest version, the other day, and with a couple of friends, Dan on the committee and Tim, who we've had on the podcast before, and already I think we've given up on it because it's not the most exciting of games. But in this game, Queen pwns a lot. She's picked a very particular thing that she does, which is fighting a dragon. And the entire game is fighting big monsters, basically. There's other bits you can do, but the main thing is it's like if you take a normal computer game and you get rid of everything else and just leave it with the boss fights at the end of every level. Basically, it's an entire game of boss fights, just massive monsters that you go in and you have to smack with a sword for 20 or 30 minutes before you kill them. So it's a long time investment. Apparently people like to watch this streaming, and this woman, Queen pwns a lot, or Becky, her real name, she has killed this dragon 4,500 times, and somehow this is entertainment. Somehow doing the same thing literally thousands of times, people are paying her to watch it. I don't get it. I don't, like, I'm obviously getting old, and some of these things are escaping me, but I just, like, after 10 times of watching her do that, I think I'd get bored. I think I'd go and find someone else, maybe even fewer than 10 times. But she keeps doing it, and she is very good at it, admittedly. Like, there are other people that have done more times for this one dragon, a la Treon. So there's one expert who's killed the dragon over 8,000 times. But she's up there. She's good. She knows what she's doing. She's one of the world's leading Alatreon killers. Amazing for her. But then she decided a few weeks ago that she was going to do it blindfolded. Now, blindfolded playing of computer games is a very different thing. It's like, this is part of the whole speedrunning community. People make up a lot of feats that you can try and do, like just beating a game in the fastest time, which is the original speedrunning. But then, can you do it without using glitches or with any glitches? Can you do it while blindfolded, which is a crazy one? And there's some impressive speedrunning that happens in things like Mario 64, where you watch people and all the little tricks they figured out. So if I push left and forwards for 5 seconds, I'm going to be in the corner. I then have to double tap this button to turn 180, and then if I jump 3 times, I know it's going to get me to this point on the level. And they do this for an entire game, where they memorize beginning to end hours and hours worth of moves that they can do blindfolded, with audio cues to let them know what's going on. And it's very impressive. But Queen pwns a lot is not a blindfolded expert. She's an amateur. She's great at killing the dragon. Apparently, a few times privately, she's tried doing it with a blindfold on. But then she did it on stream. She did it on Twitch for her audience. And as soon as blindfold runners looked at it, they went, nah, that's fake. Nope, that didn't happen. And there were some very good reasons why. The very obvious one, the big one, is when you're playing a computer game blindfolded, you need to know where your character is and where the thing you're trying to kill is, but you kind of don't care too much about where the camera's pointing. You care about the direction your sword's pointing and where the dragon is, but if your camera's pointing at the ceiling, it doesn't make a difference. Some games it will do. Some games you will hit further up or further down, depending on vertically where you're looking. Monster Hunter World isn't one of these games. So when you look at a blindfolded run, you'll see people will end up staring at the sky for half of the time, or they'll be staring at the floor because it doesn't make any difference. They're playing on audio cues. They're playing on probabilities of this character doing a particular thing. And so where they stare doesn't matter. And even if they wanted to have the camera pointing horizontally, they wouldn't be able to do it. It's a nightmare to do. But this woman, Queen Pwnzlot, her entire run, whenever the camera went up or down vertically, it was immediately righted back to pointing directly at the dragon, directly at the thing she was trying to kill. So this was the first obvious thing that was wrong. There were lots of other things that were like giveaways, like when you pause it as she's putting the blindfold on, you can plainly see that the blindfold is see-through. You know, there's little enough material that if you put it on, you're going to be able to walk around a room and not bump into anything. So I accept that when she wore this blindfold, it was probably harder than playing it normally, but I think she probably had a fairly good view of the screen. And so this was pointed out, and a guy that I watch a lot of videos of, Carl Jobst, he's a YouTuber who just documents the takedowns that happen of speedrunners that cheat. And there's a lot of cheating out there. He does a really good job of just explaining, because as I said, it's very technical. You need to be a speedrunner or a blindfolded speedrunner for particular runs. You need to be a professional to know what to look for when you're looking for a cheater. And Carl Jobst, he'll talk to these people, he'll find out what it is. He's a speedrunner, I think, in GoldenEye 007, so he's got some history himself. But he'll talk to other professionals, he'll find out why they're cheating, how we know that they're cheating, and then he'll do like a 10-20 minute video explaining it. So he did a really nice takedown video showing these are the reasons. You know, this is where a dialogue box error comes up on the screen, and immediately her mouse moves towards clicking on it, and then halfway there she suddenly remembers she's supposed to be blindfolded and the mouse stops, and then she presses the space bar to get rid of it and things like that. So he documented it, and it's a great story. But after he documented it, she wanted to prove that actually it was legitimate. And rather than proving that one was legitimate, she figured the way to do it was to do a follow-up run. And in the follow-up run, she got advice from professional speedrunners. So she bought a proper face mask, it's a sleeping mask, apparently, that's supposed to be pretty standard for speedrunners. And she put bits of paper over her monitors, and she cheated again. This time, she had two monitors that were covered by paper. She secretly had a third monitor that you couldn't see in any of her camera views, where she had the game running on that, and she was peeking out the side of her blindfold. So, like this, I guess, you know, she doesn't know how to do this properly. She doesn't know how to do it blindfolded. Probably by now, the easiest way for her to get away with this is just to learn how to do the damn thing properly. But she's not. And what I was really interested in, and what I find fascinating, is how people deal with being caught. Like, as skeptics, we spend a lot of our time trying to catch people out in lies, people who are unethical, people who are selling nonsense products. We try to show how they are duplicitous, how they're doing things wrong, how they're lying to the public. And sometimes, rarely, but sometimes we get an opportunity to just really show up someone for a barefaced lie. And as I've been talking about for the past couple of months, we're going to have a case for the New Zealand skeptics coming up that is going to be very much like this, where if everything goes to plan, we're going to have a damning amount of evidence about someone. And the question is, how does this person deal with being called out? How does this person react? What is their plan going to be once we show that they're lying, that they have been cheating? And I listed in my article a few of the different ways that I quite often see with this. And these were to publicly deny that you did anything wrong. Just pretend it never happened. Tell everybody, no, you've got it wrong. I was legitimate. Second one is making lame excuses. Oh, well, it was because my cat died and because this happened and the other happened. I was under a lot of stress. Third one is to try and delete the evidence. And we've seen a history of this. Like, H Bomber Guy has done a very good 2.5 hour video about plagiarism. And in that video, he talks about how some of the people, whenever they get caught basically stealing scripts from other people and making YouTube videos from it, they just delete their videos. They just basically go on a blitz and get rid of everything. The next one is just to ignore it. Just don't respond to it at all. Just carry on doing what you're doing. And there are some people who I've seen online like that, where you hope that nobody notices, that at least your fan base just carries on loving you if you don't even engage. Disappearing from the public eye is the next one, where you just totally go. You just not just delete everything, but you don't make anything new. You drop out of the public eye and you go and find yourself another career. And then the last one that I list is the counterattack. And this is the one I'm really worried about. When you come out with maybe a defamation lawsuit, when you figure some legal way to go after people, and quite often, even if a lawsuit doesn't happen, there can be an immediate effort to threaten a lawsuit. There can be that legal ease where someone talks to you as if they're a lawyer, or maybe even they will pay a few hundred bucks to get a lawyer to send you a letter. And what I say in my article is the one thing we never see really is people just apologize and say, how do I make amends? Like when people are caught cheating, that is hardly ever a thing that happens. And I think as far as being caught and getting away with it's concerned, I think that's probably the best one to do. Like it's the only one that seems honest, but I guess for maybe the people, the cheating honesty is just not one of their things. But so yeah, I see all of these when it comes to people being caught cheating in speed running in these videos and caught in other areas of life where they're not being honest. And with this case that's coming up for us, I don't know what we're going to get. I honestly have no idea what response we're going to get from this person, but I am a little bit worried that it might be legal action. So I could be getting us into a little bit of hot water. It's going to be fun, hopefully. I guess we'll see.
Yeah. I guess human psychology comes into it that to actually apologize is an admission that you actually did something wrong in deceiving people. And I guess that's harder than any of the other things that you list.
I guess hard, probably both psychologically to swallow, because by default, we're all the hero of our own story. We all think we're the good guy in our lives, and it's hard to accept that sometimes we're not. But I guess also legally, I imagine most lawyers, the first thing they'll recommend is don't admit any wrongdoing. Even if you've done wrong, admitting to it can be used in court. So, you know, maybe in court later on, we will put in a guilty verdict. But until that time, don't admit anything. I think that's a fairly frequent piece of advice that people are given. So yeah, it's sad that in our case I don't think we're going to get an apology, although years ago when they were caught out for doing something they did apologize partly, so maybe it's on the cards. I don't know.
It's funny,
it was
that
more of an apology for offense caused, wasn't it?
Well, yeah it was an apology for something slightly different and then a doubling down for the other stuff.
I was thinking when I was reading your story around the, like within maybe a couple of days beforehand, James Summerton had made a comeback or was in the process of trying to make a comeback.
Yeah. So the video I talked about, H Bomber Guy, his main target after going after Internet Historian, who it turns out is a Kiwi who was stealing stuff for some of his videos, and Illuminati and some others. His main target in his plagiarism video is James Summerton, who was a YouTuber that makes videos about gay culture and the influence of gay culture on, I guess, standard culture and where the influences for gay culture come from. Some very interesting videos, but it turns out that he stole most of it for a lot of his videos from other people, just literally copy and paste and read out like chapters of someone's book as if it's his own. And yeah, he did an apology, which was not an apology. His first video, he starts off with, oh, I tried committing suicide. And then he goes on to, well, his mother's sick. And then he goes on to, actually, it wasn't me. It was the other guy that was working with me. It's only my fault for not checking him properly. But yeah, he recently released a second apology video, which is much better, but there's a bit about 15 minutes in the middle that kind of backtracks a lot of his apology and again starts giving, but it's not my fault because of this, that, and the other. And it is really hard for someone just to say sorry and leave it at that. It's always sorry, but, and then a whole bunch of reasons why you did it, which is like, well, you're not really sorry then. If you're trying to justify your actions, that's not being sorry. That's just saying, actually, I'm justified in doing it. And James Summerton was no exception. And yeah, as you say, he's trying to relaunch his career. He's talking about making new videos. He says that the money from some of his videos is going to go to the people he stole from. I'm having a problem believing him on this, but I guess time will tell what happens.
Watch this space.
There is a point where this is going to be overused, and I think it was about a month
ago. I know. Yeah. Okay.
But no, it is very much a watch this space because I've been dangling it in front of our audience for 2 months now, and Dan and I are still working our butts off, and Louise has been amazing in helping. And we are getting closer to being able to go public, but we're just still not there yet. It turns out the enormity of the project we did not realize when we started.
I'm sure it's going to be interesting once it's all released and out in the public domain.
Yeah, it'll probably be news for a week and then it'll die. And I'll look at it and go, all that effort for like 1 week of news cycle. Yeah.
Well, we can stop having to be careful about not naming this person.
Actually, yeah, that would be nice. That would definitely be a bit of a relief.
All right. So what's coming up on the Skeptic calendar?
We got a couple of things in Wellington this Friday, which will be the 8th of March. We'll have our traditional bi-weekly Skeptics in the Pub at the Intercontinental Hotel on 2 Grey Street, inside the hotel in the lobby lounge. And then we actually have a date for the next Needham meetup. So they're going to be catching up at their traditional headquarters of Umbrella's Kitchen and Bar next Thursday, March 14th at 6 p.m.
Do you think they were embarrassed into actually having a meetup by us constantly saying that we hadn't heard from them?
I hope so.
This assumes they're listening to our podcast, which I think is a big assumption.
Indeed.
And then, Mark, do you have anything else for the Wellington region?
Yeah, so the 14th Thursday in Wellington, next Thursday, is our skeptical activism or science-based healthcare activism in the pub. Come along, make a complaint. We might not still have finished this project by then, so come and join us and get a little sneak peek of what we're working on from 6 o'clock.
The Auckland Skeptics in the Pub, we had ours last night. I think there must have been about 12 people there, so it was a good turnout. But Robin, who normally organises them, was away. He's doing some cycling tour around in the South Island. He is, I think, next month. So that'll be the first Tuesday in April, which would be the second, I think. Yes. The second is going to be at a different venue. It's going to be, we're going to try out the Brew on Quay. So that's on Quay Street. Apparently, it's a place that has a bit of a sort of a free function room. So it might be a bit of a better place for discussions and potentially having a speaker.
Nice.
So, yes, that would be nice to try out. But we do like the Dyson Fork, particularly when some of our members actually go and grab a game and start playing it. So anyway, yes, watch out for the notification if you're in Auckland, or even if you're not and think it's worthwhile travelling up for the stunning company of Auckland Skeptics.
No, Wellington Skeptics. Come and join the Wellington Skeptics.
Okay, well, it's a bit of a long drive if you're in Auckland anyway. You're coming up next weekend, is it?
Yep, I'll be in there for Friday and Saturday. I'm going to go see a concert with my husband.
Oh, right. Okay.
But we are going to take the opportunity to at least check in on a couple potential venues for our conference. Save the date in general for November, but hopefully we'll have some more details by the end of the month.
Is there a Venn diagram that overlaps your concert venue with our conference venues?
No, we cannot afford the venue that my concert's at. It is well beyond our budget.
Right. Okay. So is that it? We're done?
I think we've exhausted everything skeptical in New Zealand. Yep. We've run out.
Excellent. Very good. You have been listening to the YNR podcast. If you'd like to give us some feedback, you can send us an email to news@skeptics.nz and we will give it our full attention.
Or podcast@skeptics.nz if you want.
Okay. Yes, that too. Or you can write us a handwritten letter, as some religious organizations want to do.
Oh, yes, please. Where do they send that? I guess they send that to
the P.O. Box. Yeah. Oh, okay. No, that's right. Yes. Yes.
Rationalist House on Simon Street, right?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Indeed. Yes.
Care of Rationalist. Craig, do you go and check the mail at Rationalist House occasionally?
Nobody's given me that assignment.
Well, I gave you that assignment a year ago. You probably best go and do that.
Okay. remind me when we're there. Roman.
I will. I will.
Check the mail.
We'll make it our task.
Indeed.
Nice.
Very good. All right. We will see you all next time. Hopefully, by then, we'll know whether we have any mail. See you all soon. Bye.
Bye.
Kakite.
Bye.